Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, it's so nice to be back here. And it's also very nice to be back in Waterloo, where everything seems to work. And I would like to briefly discuss some sort of state-of-the-art ideas that are emerging in holography and also in S-matrix physics, and also something to do with black holes. But I'll be mostly focusing on the sort of holographic aspect of these ideas. Oh, we have a guest now. It's fine, he can stay there. That was not, okay, that's fine, yeah. It's just a nice nice corner of the screen. All right, so yeah, let me just give you some motivation. sorry, it's just funny. Yeah, sorry, that was really fun. Yeah. Oh, there we go. Yeah, anything is better than, yeah, it's great. Yeah, I hope that's not recorded. Is that recorded?
Oh, it'll be inside now.
Yeah, everything is, okay. Yeah, let me just give you some small motivation for this. Well, I'm not really a string theorist. I guess I was too late for super string revolution and all that. But somehow I learned to appreciate that we have learned some very important valuable lessons from quantum gravity and gauge theory together that nevertheless seem to be independent of string theory. But we of course, have to keep exploring these ideas. One example which you might be familiar with is ADS-CFT, and there is some sort of realization of ADS-CFT that doesn't really care whether you start from M theory, you know, 11-dimensional supergravity and all that. You can just do one-dimensional holography SYK. You can do two-dimensional Kerr-CFT near the throat. All those things, even though we're inspired by string theory, doesn't really have the stringy realizations, I should say. There is also some mechanisms that were very famous during the 70s and 80s, the anomaly cancellation, which was, of course, the first originated by Green-Schwarz in superstrings. But then we found out that it's also happened in gauge theory and all sorts of gauge twister theories and all that. So it's a very sort of universal idea. More recently, the one I want to stress is the colokinematics duality, which is something, again, that was found in string amplitudes by these people, Kawai, Levin, and Tai. But it was sort of realized that it sort of points towards a more general framework that relates color and kinematics, meaning gauge color theories and gravitational kinematical theories. And last but not least, celestial holography was also something inspired sort of by Wolfschild constructions and insertion of vertex operators in a conformal field theory, but also sort of was realized outside of the Wolfschild world. In particular, we want to use the celestial sphere as our Wolfschild. So I'll just jump into that in a second. Regarding holography, though, we know that there are many sort of outstanding developments on ADS-CFT regarding sort of negative cosmological constants, and we have some understanding of them in terms of quantum information, in terms of different approaches. But we want to sort of port those ideas into asymptotically flat spacetimes. We thought that originally, from the first results, this was not a unitary quantum theory. But now there are some new developments that make it look like closer than ever. So one of these is sort of celestial CFT, of course. But there's also Cauchy slice holography, which tries to port these ideas again from ADS-CFT. And there's a twisted holography, which I will also discuss. And in light of this, we want to ask if there is a sort of bottom-up approach to holography in these spacetimes. So we will attempt to argue that the answer is affirmative and is given by a natural reformulation of the standard for the S-matrix. By standard, of course, I have to put a star there because I mean in an effective field theory sense in which I'm working at a particular cutoff away from the Planck mass. But nevertheless, I can still compute observables, and I'm going to show you how to compute those observables. Moreover, sort of intrinsic hidden properties of the S matrix are sort of revealed or sort of underlined, unveiled by sort of recasting this sort of S matrix scattering process into a correlation function that lives in the celestial sphere. So this is the idea of celestial CFT, which essentially maps these radiation insertions into the celestial sphere, sort of exploiting the fact that the Lorentz group here acts as the SL2C group in the sphere. So in this talk, we actually want to stress out that this celestial approach sort of tags along, or is like tailor-made, or it can be thought as a consequence of color kinematics ideas. Okay, so the roadmap is something like this. Ideally, we start with flat space times. These are like the sort of low energy effective field theory description of our universe. And in particular, we have these sort of excited states called black holes. And we want to describe them in a sort of more intrinsic high energy way. And a nice connection to high energy actually was provided by twistor theory, even though the original idea was by Penrose regarding the space times. We now understand that twistor theory is intrinsically linked to a particular notion of S matrix. And sort of a map between one and the other is essentially given by the Penrose transform, which was sort of proposed in this beautiful paper by Penrose. And the S matrix that we're going to consider, as I said, it has a star on it. It doesn't really have a complete UV description. This is an effective field theory in which we can work at very sort of safe energies away from the Planck mass. And we want to still describe this S matrix in some sort of intrinsic way. And the intrinsic way is going to be given by this 2D celestial CFT, in the sense that you want to have some sort of UV complete theory that admits a good sort of change of basis between the S matrix and the CFT correlations. And in particular, you find that to define this thing, you need some sort of UV softness description of the S matrix. And the passage of this, as I said, is going to be sort of bridged by the idea of color kinematics. OK, let me just outline the two parts. So the first part is going to be about color kinematics. And this will include some technical stuff, if time permits, regarding quantum groups and twistor theory. And the second part will be just trying to translate all these S matrix ideas into black holes.
One question. Is part one supposed to then lead to part two, or are these two separate papers?
Right. So part one would be some sort of relation between celestial CFT and 4D S matrix via color kinematics. And the second part is trying to map the S matrix into some black hole background. Okay, so far all these sort of fancy-smanshy terms that may or may not ring a bell, but I want to stress out that there's some sort of nice staircase that we sort of try to explore. And so let me just tell you about celestial holography, and let me tell you about color kinematics. So color kinematics, as I said, is a relation between gauge theory amplitudes and gravitational amplitudes. So it was proposed in the current form that we understand it by these people, Bernd, Carrasco, and Johansson, in 2008. And of course, it was inspired again by string theory, and there were very important results in the 70s. But the current idea pertains to this paper. And essentially, you just take the three amplitudes. So suppose you start with four-point gluon amplitude. You know, you have three diagrams. There is a contact term you can observe in any of these three. And you can see, yes, because you have a Lie algebra, right? So you have a color structure that this sort of structure constants add up to zero. This is just a Jacobian entity, so it means that there is a notion of a gauge group. And coincidentally, it was observed in this paper that you may actually have the same relation in terms of these numerators. So this n is just encoding all the polarization and kinematic information that you can have, dot products, Lorentz invariant Mandelstams, whatever. All of these are encoded in these coefficients. And you find out that no matter how you organize these things, you can put the four-point diagram wherever, they satisfy the same relation. And so it was called the kinematic Jacobi identity. Okay. So once you have this relation, that's already some sort of duality. But more strikingly, though, the sort of gravitational analog of this amplitude in which you replace these four gluons by four gravitons is indeed given by replacing these color structure constants into in terms of kinematic structure constants. So yes, literally yes, square the gauge theory factors. Okay, so now you can have sort of two approaches to this fact regarding whether you're sort of pessimistic or optimistic. You may ask, what is the actual meaning of this kinematic Jacobi identity? Whether there's some underlying symmetry algebra in the same sense of color underlying algebras for Young Mills, or maybe it's just some funny accident. So some people would say that gravity could be very easily described, and you can use sort of, you can exploit all your developments in SUN or in N equals 4 to describe gravitational theories, and that's sort of partially true. But some other people may say that, well, this is just some accident because, you know, 4 points, you have this self-duality, it's just MHV amplitudes in 4 dimensions. Well, this actually holds more generally than just 4 points, of course, but and it holds for any helicities, but, you know, perhaps just gauge theory are just, you know, they have much more wiggle room to understand, sort of to make up for the gravitational theories. And you know, it's very hard to answer these questions in all generality, but at least I can give you some evidence that that gravity is indeed very, very, very simple. And one example I want to stress out in this talk is the following. So double copy, in the sense that I described, this is called kinematics, right? It's a generic property, in the sense that if you consider a whole space of EFTs, so effective field theories with Wilson coefficients and all that, as long as you impose some notion of minimal coupling, you can have massive particles, you can have spinning particles, whatever. As long as you impose some notion of minimal coupling, you will find immediately, as a consequence of this minimality, sort of these ideas. So in this example, I'm starting with a Broca field, a spin one field coupled to some gluons, and then you just compute all the diagrams with a lot of effort. You know, it's quantizing this Broca spin one field. Just computed in this color basis, and then you find that the gravitational sort of amplitude happens to be the square of that. And not only that, but you can actually play with the spin in the sense that if I have a color theory with matter in a spin one representation and a spin, sorry, S1 representation and S2 representation, then sort of the double copy sort of adds up the spin. So you can have, like, you know, just two Broca fields adding up to a massive spin two field and all of those things. So it seems to be more generic than just, you know, self-dual, four-point, massless, whatever. It's actually sort of generic. So the generic character of the double copy actually is ultimately the reason that this W1 plus infinity hierarchy, which I haven't really discussed yet, can be extended to EFTs, including mass and spin. So here I'm just sort of advertising a forthcoming paper. On this fact that you can derive this algebra just from this double copy. And in this part of this, we will actually focus on the simplest situation because we actually want to stress out how to derive these sort of symmetries. In the simplest situation happens to be just, again, pure graviton amplitudes, which leads to a massless symmetry algebra, but sort of explains how these things emerge. And moreover, so the first realization of this kinematic Jacobi identity emerged in the study of for the self-dual gravities, and I think you might have heard about that last week from Atul, which are known to have some sort of extended symmetries. They have Lax pairs. There is a sort of integrability notion on them. This dates back to the work of Penrose and Ward and many others. But sort of was stressed out in relation to the color kinematic duality by Monteiro and O'Connell in 2011 in a very nice paper, which they point out that this kinematic Jacobi identity is essentially is a Jacobi identity. And in recent years, we also have more evidence to suspect that there is some sort of extension of these symmetries because the gauge theory itself possesses a difference of underlying hidden structures that were sort of uncovered in the last 5 or 10 years namely in Jungian symmetry, sort of conformal and dual conformal symmetry, some positive geometry, positivity, and sort of the amplitude Wilson loop duality, which all sort of have sort of suggest that in the gravitational theory there might be something like that after this double copy idea is sort of implemented. Okay, let me just skip this motivation too. In this talk, we will just link some of these approaches to argue that scattering amplitudes in gravitational theories are sort of universally controlled by an infinite set of conserved charge. And this infinite conserved charge is just the sort of byproduct of the color kinematics duality. And in fact, it organizes very nicely in this W1 plus infinity, which is related to color kinematics. So this was observed first in the context of celestial CFT in all these papers. And it sort of resurfaced some very old developments from self-dual gravity and sort of led to more developments also in the direction of classical holography. In particular, there is this nice result here coming from people at PI that sort of pointed out that there is this surface charge representation of W1 plus infinity. So essentially, you just can compute this sort of surface integrals at non-infinity associated to radiation. So just so that we're all in the same page, we're talking about some flat space-time here in which there is some notion of radiation at infinity. It's given by some particular Nius tensor in the celestial sphere. And you just sort of do some smear integral of this new tensor, some surface integral, and compute you have to integrate in U as well, and just compute some notion of charge. And if you just use like the usual sort of canonical commutation relations, you find again there is this hierarchy of symmetries. Also makes connection with twisted holography in the gauge theory case, which was also studied by Kevin here, and it has also been realized in sort of SYK systems by Sabrina and Berlinde. Okay, so this is the algebra, just so that we're all on the same page. It actually has this infinite tower of generators. I should have written here that the first one corresponds to the first one is central charge, it doesn't really couple to the S matrix, but this three half guy is actually the origin of the super translations. This spin 2 guy is the super rotation guy, and then you have this whole hierarchy that just keeps increasing. And this is some sort of canonical derivation of it, which translates into the same thing that was proposed in this paper here. Okay, so from the sort of 2D holographic world, the hierarchy that I just described can be recast into an infinite set of 2D Kalmudi currents. And these Kalmudi currents live in the gauge group UN. If we want to get W1 plus infinity, we just take N to infinity. And this is related to sort of the gravitational celestial CFT via the color kinematics correspondence. So how does that work? Well, you start with the 4D gauge theory, and you know that if you want to get to the gravitational theory, you have to sort of do this replacement in which you take your color factors and then sort of turn it into kinematic factors. Well, in the 2D setup, you start with some sort of Kalmudi theory, which is a gauge theory for SUN, and then this replacement is sort of automatically made for you by taking the n to infinity limit. Just because as you take n to infinity limit of UN, you essentially recover some part of W1 plus infinity. And so you're essentially landing in this gravitational theory. And so this was. Sorry, can you speak loud? Yeah, so you just take the UN generators, actually not just the generators. You have to find a particular representation of the generators. But as you take n to infinity, so you can think of this acting on some particular lattice, which is sort of quantized. As you take n to infinity, you're taking sort of the continuum or the classical limit, and you essentially get all these simple ectomorphisms on the cylinder. Yeah, this was pointed out in a paper by Hope. Okay, so before deriving the correspondence, because there are some experts in the audience, I just want to sort of flesh out some technical details, which you may or may not relate to, but in general, this is sort of the framework that we're adopting by describing things as insertions, as I said, in the celestial sphere. The way that the W1 plus infinity algebra emerges is essentially by trading lambda tilde by some sort of color, charge. So let's see how this proceeds. So you may or may not have heard about Weinberg's soft theorem. It's essentially the fact that if you insert a soft graviton acting on a hard particle, you get a sort of universal factor, a Lie order in omega. And if you start looking at this more carefully, you can introduce these coordinates lambda and lambda tilde. And what happens is that lambda tilde sort of shows up polynomially. So the pole here is only holomorphic pole, and the sort of anti-holomorphicity is all encoded in this bracket 1 and 2. If you haven't seen this bracket, let me just briefly sort of define it for you. This 1 and 2 is just epsilon tensor of lambda 1 tilde, lambda 2 tilde. Okay? So because lambda tilde is one set bar, then you just get the first expression. And we want to think about this 1, 2 now as some sort of color structure constant. And indeed, it happens to be a structure constant of SU to infinity. And this implies that H1 is some sort of holomorphic Kadmoudi current. And the same thing can happen at sort of all the sort of sublink orders in the energy. So how does that proceed in general? Well, for general sort of energy, for general energy, what you have is that all the set bar dependence can be sort of condensed into this nice conformal block. So if you start looking at the OPE of two insertions here, the sort of conformal symmetry tells you that the whole tower of SL2R descendants will appear in this block form. And what you do is essentially you just sort of recast this set bar in terms of these lambdas, right? So after you introduce these lambdas, this integral over T is like an integral over set bar, and it becomes this sort of lambda tilde integral, right? And what you need to do is you need to just rewrite sort of the kernel of this integral in a sort of color-like way. Essentially, just by looking at this expression, you find that lambda tilde, so the set bar here, is a composition of the lambda tildes of G and O. And that's essentially the sort of momentum conservation delta function. So what we're doing is we're starting from this sort of CFT-like language of the celestial sphere having like two sort of primary insertions, and then translated it back into color. And once you translate it back into color, you get that this sort of conformal kernel just becomes a simple sort of momentum conservation constraint. So once you have this momentum conservation constraint, it was pointed by this person, Hoppe, in his actual PhD thesis, that it corresponds to a Kadmoudi, it corresponds to a structure constant in which you start with SUN in some particular basis. It's something very close to the Cartan basis, and then take large N. So sort of the color conservation constraint turns into this momentum conservation constraint.
Can I ask a question here, Jane?
Please.
Can you retroconnect your double copy conditions to the angular conditions that Brown's constraint to do with the current
dissociative story?
Or no?
Yeah. This will, if you hold that thought for two slides, we will come back to the sort of associativity of this structure. So, of course, once you have this thing, and Hoppe tells you it's a structure constant, you know there's associativity, and in fact, you can just show it. It's a one-line argument to show that this thing is associative. But the relation to double copy is what I want to stress out. So let me just point out that generic gravitons can be interpreted in this sense, as I just described, as some Kadmoudi currents. and that associativity of the OPE actually has some imprint in the S matrix. So that's not something we usually think about. We don't usually think of the S matrix as being some associative operator. We know that if you start taking soft limits, things start not commuting. If you have gluons at sublinear order, there is some sort of non-commutativity there. But once you start taking like consecutive soft particles in a particular prescription, you find a realization of this notion, as long as you have double copy. So let me just very briefly sort of point out a different sort of result coming from this idea. Essentially, you can have some sort of scalar field for the negative helicity gravitons. So I already told you what the positive gravitons are, but the negative helicity gravitons look like some sort of a scalar function. I'm not going to go into much detail because this part is actually not is technical in the sense that you have to deal with these singular configurations that appear in the S matrix at 3 points. But once the dust settles, somehow you can still interpret these sort of primary operators in your Kac-Moody algebra as negative helicity gravitons. And this also resonates with some recent ideas, which emerged also in the previous paper and also in this nice paper by Rocario, in which you start taking these Gostom modes that transform sort of linearly under the action of soft gravitons. So he's taking this adjoint field here and acting with a soft graviton sort of generates W1 plus infinity. Yeah. I didn't want to delve into that point. Yeah, that's a sort of technical step that you need to realize at 3 points. If you have the absence of poles, in this matrix there is no poles at 3 points, so essentially you can just deform your contour away from the kinematic conservation delta function into infinity, but this is something that only happens at three points. So it's not something that is a generic property of these correlation functions. But yeah, we should definitely keep talking about that because this is something that really really bugs me and I know bugs many people. Yeah, I agree. So I shouldn't say more right now. Pertaining to your question, so actually you can start asking now, what about this associativity constraint? So you start by taking this 4-point amplitude. Like the usual way we talk about associativity in CFT is just taking different sort of limits of the OPE on a 4-point function, say, right? So we can start taking sort of G1 and G2 close, and then make it close with G3, or we can start taking G2 and G3 close and then make it close with G1, and so on. And if we take these different prescriptions, sort of the overall sort of contour integral around these three poles actually gives a vanishing contribution, which is the fact that somehow this is defined on a CP1, on an actual sphere, and not in a plane. So there's no residue at infinity after you do this contour integral. So after you do this contour integral, essentially you get the usual kinematic Jacobi identity, or the Jacobi identity if you're in the color theory. And let me just stress out that sort of these three contributions essentially correspond to the three diagrams that we had in the beginning for the double copy. The first one related to the fact that 1 and 2 are collinear, 1 and 4 are collinear, and then sort of 1 and 3 are collinear. You can also keep doing it at higher points. You can just keep adding gravitons. And this is something that you can also do via contour integrals, just sort of integrating the singularity in the OPE limit at around infinity. You essentially get sort of this residue at infinity. And depending on what theory you're choosing, maybe you want to compute MHV or next to MHV amplitude. This residue at infinity actually has different forms, so it's something that the CFT doesn't really determine. But nevertheless, a nice result is that the residue at infinity is always some sort of polynomial term. that can be determined from momentum conservation. So, so essentially what happens is that you can have, you know, if you go to next to MHV or next to MHV, there will be some sort of collinear or like multilinear, multi-particle poles and all that. But after you start expanding in the soft limit, like if you start expanding in this soft energy, all these sort of multi-particle poles are going to go to infinity. So all these sort of residues are encoded in this contour integral at infinity. And we don't know how to determine that infinity. It's also related to inserting soft gravitons at infinity. But it's a non-universal feature, which is exactly the sort of non-universality of soft theorems at sublinear orders. So that's something, of course, that deserves more attention. So this also resonates with BCFW, of course, but it's not exactly quite that, and it has been stressed in these papers. So this is a part I call how sausages are made that I don't usually discuss. I will only discuss the first slide of this part because of time mainly, and also because I know you have been having also some interesting discussions on this, so I can skip it mostly. But the part I want to stress out somehow is that all this construction, all the sort of Kathmulli ideas that come from this sort of replacements, n to infinity, this sort of color realization of the kinematic side, all of this, including Hopf's thesis, sort of come to a natural realization in twister space. And Hopf, he didn't know anything about twister space or anything like that. He just observed some property of SUN and take the large n limit and find these diffeomorphisms on the cylinder. But if you actually look at what he did, I mean, it's very close to twister space. So essentially what happens is that in the celestial sphere, you can sort of vibrate with these mu fibers. So this mu fiber is essentially just a complex sort of mu plus and minus coordinates. And once you have these fibers, essentially you can just trade these fibers by color if you just do some sort of Fourier transform. So mu's, you should think of the Fourier transform of lambda tilde. And the lambdas are essentially just the directions on the sphere. So that's how it sort of you recover for the kinematics. Yes, starting from this sort of twister construction.
If you like your papers, and believe the twister construction is fairly, it's like you're trying to reverse engineer. So, like, would you say that you're starting from the twister construction, like forgetting about the world, or would you say you want to be inspired by it, like just kind of reverse engineer the toy model to be on the symmetry?
Yeah, there are many ways to address it and many ways to start from different points, but. If you just look at Hopf's PhD thesis, right, he has mu plus and mu minus generators. So he essentially had the whole twister idea sort of in parallel to the twister world. And the mu plus and mu minus are actually generators of a quantum group. There's a Heisenberg algebra that is essentially just the quantum version of these sort of canonical commutation relations. So that's actually what he's exploiting to realize SUN. This also is a very famous construction known as the simplectron after you quantize the canonical commutation relation. So I just want to stress out that these ideas are sort of underlying, again, the whole double sort of color kinematics construction. But of course, I'm not going to go into like all those details. I want to refer to these sort of nice mathematical papers that I've been trying to read every now and then. They are definitely sort of beyond my scope, but I'll be happy to talk about that with any of you.
There's one silly question, maybe this is like, if the two same structure of the double copy is coming from the same, that's like normally how they could start from, right? So otherwise, you'd be feeling an S algebra in literature that's like an old math paper,
right? Right, yeah, this is one explanation for like, at least the self-dual part of the double copy. Which was also brought up in the paper by Monteiro and O'Connell. And let me just very briefly flesh out how the construction goes. Maybe Maybe.
Can you see what?
Yeah.
You mentioned these Jungian structure.
Yeah, what's going on there? So WN, so for that we need to go into the actual structure of W. It's a classical limit of a particular quantum group, which is like this big W, which is the limit of WN. And these guys are not really Lie algebras. Like they don't really close if you start looking at, you know, Jacobi relations or the OP in some sort of nonlinear realization. And it was emphasized in some of these papers that they admit some sort of hop algebra structure related to, once you have a hop algebra, that's essentially a Jungian. So, but that's something that maybe Kevin or more people here know way better than me. What I want to stress out is that, of course, there's this Jungian sort of spirit of the big quantum W that sort of resonates with the fact that in Jan Mills we also have an N equals 4 like SUN Jungian. So it might also be something to explore. Without going into many details about that, the sort of punchline of this part of the talk is you start with something that essentially just a quantum version of these twister coordinates. And you sort of compute the coherent states or the sort of representations of these guys just by exponentiating this. And you find that they satisfy some funny Heisenberg algebra. And you can think of this lambda as some sort of color, but also as momentum, right? Because you have the addition of lambda 1 and lambda 2, that's essentially momentum conservation. And that only buys you two coordinates, lambdas. But once you fiber your celestial sphere with these twister coordinates, you have essentially this affine algebra. And once you take the exponential, well, that exponential here, which is just some SUN generator, happens to be matched to some sort of vertex operator in the celestial sphere. So now we're making contact with actual insertions in the celestial sphere. And you can just compute the analog of this sort of current, Heisenberg algebra, and you essentially find this simple sort of coherent vertex operator structure. And once you take the large N limit, again, this reduces to this algebra, and this reduces to some sort of three-point graviton amplitude. So this is just essentially getting the sort of graviton OPE from just starting from this sort of affine OPE. And again, as I said, you start by fibering your celestial sphere with these twister coordinates. Okay, so we can start asking about the analogy. Of course, I told you these are Kalmudic currents where the structure constants have something to do with kinematics. So essentially, I'm getting this four-dimensional kinematics by two-dimensional color and two-dimensional worksheet coordinates. Okay, so that's all that has to do with color kinematics and the realization in terms of the twister theory. But in this case, what we want to do in the second part of the talk is relate that to black holes and actually to space-times. So so this is something that has been floating around in many other languages. I particularly believe that the twister language is the right way to talk about that, and I will explain why. So if you actually recast the actual formula, just sort of very briefly flesh out, this is sort of the OPE, just written in a very simple sort of exponential form. You can recast this OPE in terms of Lorentz invariant quantities. So here, instead of just shifting my momenta, I just act with some angular momentum operator that does the shift. And I recast this lambda tilde bracket in terms of just dot products, just 4D dot products. So why am I doing this? Well, because I want to get back to the space-time. I want to get back to a notion of four-dimensional space-time. So I start by sort of describing these OPEs as collinear singularities, right? So I'm sort of going backwards from the usual approach in which we start from S matrix, four-dimensional, and then we go to 2D. Here, I just told you how to derive this 2D things from twister space, and I'm going back to four dimensionals. four-dimensional amplitudes. So here I can think of a graviton and sort of massive particle or massless particle sort of having this collinear singularity. It has this ball, K1, K2, some sort of polarization dependence, and then there is some sort of angular momentum operator depending whether this thing has cap, has a spin or not. Of course, it can be extended to massive momenta because you just wrote it in Lorentz covariant form. So you can just pretend that these particles are massive if you just put a mass square in the denominator. Literally nothing changes. You just put a mass square there, and the whole covariant structure just sort of goes through. Now the sort of relation with the space-time is sort of implicit in the fact that there is some collinear singularity that tells you that you have some sort of on-shell radiation. That on-shell radiation can be interpreted in a different signature as the black hole or the space-time metric. And the way to reinterpret that has to do with how to describe a black hole in effective field theory. So in effective field theory, we don't really have a Penrose diagram, like a fully formed Penrose diagram with singularities and horizons. What we have is some sort of singular source that emits radiation. If your space-time is stationary, there is no radiation. There's just Coulomb potentials. And so you have to find a way of telling me how to relate that Coulomb potential to radiation. And in principle, that's not possible because these are independent degrees of freedom.
The fact that the memory effects in the software are basically considering something that only has a Coulomb, can you directly try to reverse the Coulomb quite a bit? You mean
migrate it? Yeah.
Change as basically
put it in software. Yeah, that's a great point. So, there is one way in which you can talk about Coulomb modes as, you know, essentially heading to space infinity, and then there's some relation, some constraint relation that sort of shifts these radiation modes by the memory effect. All those constraints, somehow we want to find them from some like a bottom-up approach, right? We don't want to have anything to do with Einstein equations at this point. So we don't really have the constraint equations at this point. But yes, if you had those, then essentially you can relate.
Yeah, it would be related, right?
Yeah.
But you're saying you said all the Coulomb fields in your signature, and it's just radiated fields.
Yeah. That's the idea. Although.
But it's not like the standard integrated signature, though, right? Like it should be separate.
Yeah. I agree. So that's a sort of cool thing that you can actually sort of analytically continue these Coulomb modes, and from this matrix, it's completely obvious why this happens. But just from the sort of Penrose diagram story, it's not evident at all. Like, why should this thing be related to non-infinity? It's something that, yes?
Do you mind saying a bit of this Kerr space in twister space?
Kerr space in twister, Kerr? Yeah, of course. Yeah, that's something I'll get to that. Yeah. That's, hold that thought, it will be shown. So we have this OPE, and the OPE, as I told you, it's just a collinear limit. So there is nothing fancy. You can have a massless or massive particle. You just put some, you know, P instead of K for massive. Just put A if you want instead of the angular momentum operator. You can put the Pauli-Lewinsky vector. It doesn't really change anything. The starting point is the initial OPE that we got from this twister space. And the amplitude story is, of course, clear. Now, the complicated part is this Coulomb potential that we have to reproduce. So it's not clear how these two things sort of connect. Now, before I go into that, let me just at least tell you that 3 points is harder than 4 points. Because at 4 points, everything, you know, there's sort of radiation because you have some accelerated situation. So there's no sort of Coulomb mode that you want to find. So in this case, if you think about a four-point amplitude with two gravitons, the sort of matching is kind of obvious. You just think of the sort of gravitational waves affecting some word line, some effective source in different ways. And you can ask how these commute with each other, essentially just by sort of splitting this correlation function in three terms. And you have three different singularities, right? So that tells you how they operate in this source. Now, the sort of technical prescription for this is you start with your four-point amplitude, you sort of find it, you sort of write it in this sort of color kinematics way, and you sort of identify all the numerators being one of these particular diagrams. Or you can start with your sort of CFT correlation function and then do a three-dimensional contour integral. Once you do this three-dimensional contour integral, essentially you get you sort of absorb the color structure in the Jacobian of this integral and get back the Jacobian identity. So there's some sort of technical stuff as well, but the main idea is that you can just sort of decompose these amplitudes into collinear limits.
What is C3?
Right, okay, that's a great point. Yeah, so of course, G1 and G2 are insertions in the sphere, P1 and P2 are not. And the integral is three-dimensional, so you actually have to integrate another extra coordinate. In the massless case, it's clear that this extra coordinate is like the sort of outgoing matter field, right? In this case, it's something like that, but you need to sort of give me a prescription to map a massive vector into the sphere. And that's completely worked out by Penrose, or even before, perhaps, where he observed that you take some sort of light cone, and if you just sort of pick a particular null direction, call it L, it's some principal null direction, then there is a particular intersection of any massive vector with your null sphere at a coordinate set. So that's exactly that set. So I'm integrating one massive particle. Yeah. And actually, I didn't tell you. Well, this should have been here. I'm going to go back to the point that Kevin asked, how to describe the Kerr black hole in the sort of twister framework. But before I jump into that, I want to stress out that there is something that simplifies your life when you want to match Coulomb solutions to scattering amplitudes, and that's 2.2 black holes. And the reason is that once you analytically continue to 2.2 signatures, so you can do that in a variety of ways, but if you pick one particular prescription, you find that there is a particular horizon in your Kleinian black hole that sort of captures radiation in a simple way. Let me put it in a different way. So radiation here actually flows null in a null direction just because your horizon happens to be a space direction. So if you actually let me just say Coulomb fields actually flow in a null direction because your horizon appears to be space-like. So it's going to go straight into the horizon, and it's going to go straight into null infinity. So the upshot is that at the end of the day, doing the analytic continuation sort of takes these radiation modes to infinity, and then you can read it off by just computing your favorite scattering amplitude. Right.
Basically have some sources, like some heavy operations or whatever, and the Bradisson mode is just like the reaction of the geometry to that, and then there's an infinite spin or whatever, and somehow you're using three-point functions like plus whatever general covariance gave you the full volumetric, because I think it's weird how you're able to probe which is a three-point or two, like four-point amplitude, the fact that it's current,
Yeah, so from the perspective of the three-point amplitude, the main point is that there is no sort of on-shell support in Lorentzian signature. In Lorentzian signature, right? The three-point amplitude has no on-shell support in Lorentzian signature. It only has And that's exactly the fact that the three-point amplitude is stationary, because it only has a source emitting something. And it's stationary, and it's on shell. So that means it's zero, right? Because it's an amplitude, and then it's stationary, so there is no radiation.
So you're changing signatures in effect of that. And then the question is, you're basically saying you're probing like the this Kerr geometry, where you know the horizons is like that just from one graviton coupling to a particle with its spin.
Yeah, the spin doesn't really play a role. I mean, it's just the fact that you have a coupling between graviton and a particle in 2.2. It can be a scalar particle. I mean, the fact that in 2.2 you can have support for 3-point amplitudes,
sure,
in real.
Just, yeah, but this is just an
example.
Yeah. I'm saying that at some point when you're jumping to this geometry, you're making some. There's
no, this is just analytic continuation. So you just take your four-dimensional black hole and then analytic continue.
So scattering a given black hole geometry, there should be something
there. Yeah. Well. Okay. Let's just talk about that later. But the main idea is that there is no really scattering, I guess. There's just a source emitting a radiative mode in 2.2 and emitting a stationary mode in 3.1. And there's no scattering of the black hole is stationary. There's no dynamics. There's no time evolution. It's just a Coulomb mode. And you can just derive it from 2.2 by looking at it from null infinity. But you know, that's just some sort of virtual way of deriving the radiated part. It's not some physical trick, like it's not Lorentzian radiation. Yeah, but again, we should get back to that point. But maybe in the interest of time, let me just briefly flesh out. So once you are in this 2.2 scenario, which you can think of sort of the real slice of the twister space, you happen to find yourself in some sort of RP1 contour, and the Penrose construction, which of course I don't really have much time to describe, happens to be a contour integral around this RP1. Now, the main point is that the integrand of this thing. The integrand of the Penrose transform. Okay, so the output of the Penrose transform is a metric, is h mu nu, depending on whether space time you want to find. The input of the Penrose transform, the actual integrand, is a twister amplitude. So the way we get this integrand is exactly by plugging in the all amplitude that we got from the OPE or from just this collinear analysis. All of this, once you transform to twister space, can be plugged into Penrose machinery. So essentially, if you want to know how that is done, it's essentially just taking a Fourier transform in terms of lambda tilde and mapping it to mu. Right. So just take your amplitude in terms of lambda tilde. The usual momentum amplitude, and then find a twister function. And then the twister function gets plugged into this, and then you use the incidence relations of Penrose and sort of twister transform it to a space-time metric. The cool thing, though, is that what happens if you put a four-point function rather than a three-point function? So I told you that this will give you Kerr black holes. In this sense, if you actually plug in a four-point function, what you have is a Kerr black hole perturbed by a gravitational wave, right? So in the sense of you have your effective source, and then there is some sort of perturbation that makes it dynamical. That all can be sort of formalized into the fact that there is an extra insertion of a graviton that sort of counter-integrating that extra insertion of a graviton gives you a deformation of the original Kerr metric. In terms of this amplitude. So now we are talking about RP1 for one graviton and RP1 for the other graviton. And essentially, at linear order, if you want, just linearize amplitude gives you solutions of the perturbation of Kerr black holes, which are solutions of the Tolkowski equation.
Yeah.
So,
just to clarify the question before, was basically the fact that in the box, instead of
right. Right. Great. Yeah. That's also another way of seeing it. That I really like that perspective a lot, and that's something that we exploited in the last paper. Essentially, you can think of these sort of care massive operators as some sort of screening operators that charge this graviton. So the one-point function is not zero. Yeah, this procedure, there's a term for this procedure in CFT. I don't exactly remember. But just plug in these sort of extra charges, and now you can compute this as an effective one-point function of a graviton, and this as an effective two-point function of a graviton. And the interesting thing is that now you can think about this one-point function in a particular state, in a particular quantum state. So that's actually what connects to my recent paper related to the fact that you have this sort of graviton coherent state acting on the vacuum, just a 2D CFT vacuum. And once you have this particular black hole state, you can just compute one-point functions. So we're just translating this sort of one-point function back and forth in terms of this three-point function.
So here you think these are Boltzmann modes. Are there other kind of Boltzmann modes that arise naturally? The same Boltzmann modes that you took in the discrete cases?
Great, yeah, great. So these Goldstone modes are yeah, let me just show you. Well, maybe I should. Yes, over there. Yeah, these Goldstone, I mean, we should definitely talk about that. But the idea is that you start with some sort of polynomial form of your metric. So essentially, some formula like this. What this does, it extracts some sort of polynomial part of the metric, and so these are essentially the Goldstone modes that you also explore.
He would be very careful about whether he says that n is on one side or the other. Like, so this is the tower that's going in any sort of range.
Yeah, but we're working on 2.2 signature. So this.
So should you think about the n if it's positive for you, right?
Oh yeah, this is positive. Yeah. So essentially h omega is some step function. Okay, we should let me just wrap up the talk and then we'll discuss that. But as I said, there is some sort of Goldstone charge that creates this state, and now this sort of three-point amplitude becomes just a one-point function, okay? And just expectation value of that one-point function, if you twist or transform, or if you just consider momentum space or position space, happens to match the one-point Kerr metric. So in this talk, we have derived the kinematic algebra from SUN. We also sort of rediscovered this four-dimensional sort of kinematic space starting from a celestial sphere with some color structure using, of course, the 2.2 signature. And of course, I hope I convince you that W1 plus infinity shows up in all these different aspects in sort of different ways, but sort of connects back to all sort of Kerr metric. And again, there is much more to explore. And in particular, I'm very interested about this one over R to the n expansion that has been pointed out in these papers. And I think that's one way of connecting back to space-time that we should be exploring. So that's all I want to say for now. Thank you. Yeah, not really.
You're not working on the twister space of some solvable geometry.
No, not really. You can take, if you plug, I should have said what's plus and minus, but these guys are plus. If you plug in the minus amplitude.
Sorry,
but I'm pointing at this. Yeah, so if you plug in the plus amplitude, then you get the plus metric. If you plug in the minus amplitude, you get the minus metric. And so you can just add them. Yeah.
So the twister space you're working on is the twister space from Minkowski space, is that right? And then this is some some excitation of it.
Yeah. That was all worked out in Penrose and Drindler in that book that they have.
And then I want to just ask something. Because this is actually something wrong here. So that you're taking n to be positive integer there, and you're not taking the basically one part of the Boltzmann.
Right, yeah, so okay, that is a technical point. I'm not sure this audience is particularly interested in that. But the idea is that there is some sort of shift that happens every time you have radiation, right? As you know, you can think of the H, you know, 0, 0 or something. There's some theta function on it. But there is also, in retarded time. In retarded time, there's a theta function. And then you can start asking about sort of subling orders in the energy by taking different derivatives of this theta function. Right? So like the leading Gostom mode would be just a shift, and then the other guys, like the subleading guys, are sort of subleading shifts, and that of course this goes to omega n. I think what you want to have is something polynomial. Maybe you want to have something polynomial. So these are like the subleading orders in energy, so that when you plug it here, you get just the integral gives you something like, that's essentially what you want. You want to extract sort of the n derivative of this sort of a step function.
Sure, but so I guess the point would be that this is one where you are g delta or whatever for the graphite. These are not subgraphites. This is like the kind of subgraphite part here.
So this would be the Gostom mode. Yeah, it's like the soft, it's like the zero energy mode for n equals zero. But as you increase the order in the n, like, on the graviton side, it's going to be subleading in energy. But on the Gostom side, it's going to be sort of subleading in derivatives of energy, right?
Sure. I think I would just say that, like, if you just look at that, right, this is delta goes to positive, delta minus 1, right, is not in the kernel there. So you're saying that the series doesn't have any poles, and
These guys don't enter in amplitude. They decouple. So you are saying that these guys are pair, essentially. Yeah. So this is like the subleading graviton.
No, I was talking about them. Like, they're not subleading gravitons. They're like the subleading.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm saying this guy is the graviton and this guy is the Gostom.
Sure.
So these guys are pair in that sense.
Sure.
Yeah.
Is there an argument that equals 2k plus 3 plus 0?
Yeah, well, the algebra shows up in many contexts. Is that your question? I mean, it has a W1 plus infinity algebra. Yeah, it shows up in many contexts. I'm still trying to figure out what, you know, when you have all these sort of mathematical coincidences, but many systems have W algebras, you may start asking whether the systems themselves are related or not. And so SYK, of course, Sabrina found this example. There is critical strings, there is all sorts of systems we're exploring right now. It's very hard to pinpoint what physical relation you would expect. But yeah, that's a great direction.
Okay, maybe these red suits have had to be about that with the skin error.
Right. Yeah.
If not, there is a speaker here at 6.
Great. Great.